This episode of Podnuts Pro is dedicated to the memory of our good friend, Eric Ardini. Please stay tuned after the podcast for a very special message. Everyone, and welcome to another episode of Podnuts Pro. I am your host, Marvin. Okay, I'm not going to clean that up in editing. I'm just going to keep on going. I am your host, Marvin B., coming at you from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where it is always fantastic. And today, folks, we have a guest on the show. We are going to be talking cybersecurity with Kyle Milicheski. I will do a full intro later, but I think you're going to enjoy this conversation, of course. When I'm talking about cybersecurity, you know there's going to be an education involved somehow as somebody teaches me a thing or two. So let's go ahead and get some housekeeping out of the way as per usual. So of course, the first thing we want to do is talk about the conference that will be coming up this September 20th and 22nd in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That of course is the 2019 annual TechCon Unplugged. Folks, you want to head over to techconunplugged.com and get your ticket. Again, $199 gets you in for everything, food, content. There's going to be some great presentations there. If you head over to the website, you'll see some of the speakers we've got. We've got our friends from Malwarebytes. We've got some marketing specialists out there, Matthew Rodella, Elizabeth Lamb. We've got HIPAA Compliance, Mark Hackleston. Alexa Platt Lee, Freedom Voice. There's going to be so much more coming down the road. But go ahead and head over to TechCon Unplugged and get your tickets, look at the speakers, schedule all of that good stuff. And I do want to go back. And last week, I had asked you, well, 2 weeks actually, when this show is posted, 2 weeks ago, I asked you to go to the GoFundMe page to help our friend Eric Ardini. Folks, if you've been listening to any of the Podnut shows for a number of years, you have heard the name Eric Ardini. I know that some of you have gone on and contributed. Eric is dealing with a rare form of primary liver cancer. His sister put up this page, and they are looking for help to pay some of the bills. This is one of those diseases where it's going to take a lot of money to take care of those medical bills, also to help his family. They need to spend some time together. They don't need to be worried about money. So I know that there are several of you out there that can contribute. I actually do want to thank a couple of people that specifically told me or mentioned me that they contributed, Tom Bull, Paul Mendiola. I know there are many others that our owner of the Podnuts Network, Door-to-Door Geek, mentioned on a show of his recently, all the listeners that have contributed, all the people that know about Podnuts and what this community means to the tech world, how we've all helped each other. So folks, hey, let's get together now and help Eric out. He is one of our founding members of the network. As of today, there are 98 people that have contributed. Listen, we should be double that by now. So folks, go to the GoFundMe page. Look for Eric Ardini, help Eric Ardini and family. Ardini is spelled A-R-D-U-I-N-I. Of course, I will have a link in the show note. So if you can't find it, go to the Podnuts Pro page, look for Eric Ardini's link, go there and contribute something. All right. And with that, let me also mention a sponsor for today's show. And folks, you have heard me talk about Kalyptid Security for quite some time. You know that they have been a great firewall vendor for the small business community, especially us that are techs and MSPs. Kalyptid makes network easy. They do one thing and one thing only. They put together the Access Enforcer firewall that can be set up in minutes and help protect your clients from hackers and malware, also includes all the things you need for intrusion prevention, VPN tunnels, web filtering, tons of other features. So from the perspective of us as techs, if you are tired of being ignored by your firewall vendor, then you've got to try Calyptics. If you're used to dealing with other vendors, you'll be amazed at the service at Calyptics. You sign up for a partner for free. Every partner gets free training. You get free tech support from US-based engineers. The support, folks, is fantastic. You simply call, they answer, they solve your problem, and you can't ask for much better than that. The program partner is also flexible. You can pay for service by the month or by the year. You can move your firewalls from one site to another. Folks, this thing is easy. It almost self-runs itself. So make sure you make note of that. Also make note of the fact that Calyptics does not sell online. So it's not like you're going to be competing against them and finding their products out on the internet somewhere. They do not sell through distributors. They only sell through IT shops like mine and yours. So folks, head over to Calyptics.com, put a /pod on the end, and you'll be able to sign up for a demo and save $100 on your first order. So Calyptics.com/pod to save $100. All right. And that will do it for housekeeping today. Let me get on over to our guest. And I mentioned his name earlier, Kyle Milicheski. And he is a CISSP. I'm sure that a lot of you are wondering what that is, but that is a Certified Information Systems Security Professional. And let me just tell you, that ain't no joke, folks. That is a legit certification in our industry. Kyle works for a company called Design Studios, and one of the reasons that I was going to have them on my show, the owner, Andrew Rank, I have known for a little while. I met him through ASCII. Andrew helped me out tremendously back between Christmas and New Year's last year when I was over in Tampa trying to get my law firm client moved from one office to two offices, and I ran into an issue where we just ran out of people to assist because, of course, between Christmas and New Year's, who really wants to work? But Andrew actually, even though he's based out of Miami, had some techs over in the Tampa area, had one be able to be redirected, scramble over to help me get some stuff done. That was tremendous. So even though Andrew was supposed to be on the show today, he's not able to because the man is working, making money. So I still want to say thank you to Andrew. Kyle Milicheski, he's not his replacement because Kyle was going to be on here anyway, but we are going solo. So Kyle, welcome to the show. How are you doing today, sir?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the warm welcome. Yeah, I'm doing great.
All right. And now you are up in the New England area, specifically Vermont. And now I know that it's April. You should be thawing out about now. Is that correct?
We should be, yeah. We still have 6 inches of snow on the ground, though. It is balmy 50 degrees today.
Ooh, that's not right. Oh my goodness. So Kyle, let's start with the easy stuff first. So you're there at Design Studios, and when techs hear another company called something like Design Studios, doesn't sound like a techie name. So tell us a little bit about Design Studios and what you guys do.
Sure. So the name is a bit of a fun story that I've had the privilege of hearing from Andrew. So he started Design Studios back in 1999 as a software development firm that did secure developing. So he was spending a great deal of time flying between Miami and Denver, Colorado, and trying to get this startup going out of his dorm room, which he actually successfully did. It also kind of put us on the map as experts in cybersecurity way back in the day when no one really even knew what cybersecurity was, and it was still a buzzword being used by media and marketing. So we have a very, very long history in the industry of being married to cybersecurity. And while we don't do software development anymore, which is why we have the design name, we still design solid security solutions for companies of any size, within any role as well.
Okay. So let's, well, before I ask that question, let me ask, so this certification, CISSP, do you know, like, when that started and how long that's actually been effect, and when did you become one?
So I've been a CISSP for about 6 months now. It was a journey that took me, I want to say, about a year of actual work on achieving. But it is something that takes years and years and years to build up the right amount of experience to basically get. So there are 5 years of verified experience that you must have specifically within the cybersecurity field that dives into several domains that are defined by the governing body, ISC Squared. ISC Squared has been around since, I think it's the 90s or so, as kind of experts in the whole cybersecurity field and putting together this governing body of individuals. So looking now, they were founded in 1989, okay, so actually a little bit earlier than I thought. And they put together the CISSP certification in the mid-90s to kind of become the authority and standard for the cybersecurity professional. And we've had a lot of changes in the industry over those years, but basically these are individuals who have been endorsed by a board of cybersecurity professionals themselves with significant experience. So it's an endorsement from other professional cybersecurity practitioners who basically go out and endorse other people who have shown their due diligence and done all of the hard work in the trenches to kind of earn the title,
okay,
as it were.
So this isn't one of those that you can just hop on the internet, find a brain dump, and pass a course in a couple of hours.
No, definitely not. And they're very tricky as well. They hold their tests near and dear to their heart. But what I can basically say is that you'll spend, 6 months going through the textbooks and the boot camp, and you'll get to the test, and it will be completely different from what you studied. So it's a way of thinking and a way of approaching a problem versus trying to just memorize standards. You really have to understand how the standards can be interpreted and apply to the problem. So it really is more of something that focuses kind of on the engineering mentality of, you know, how certain pieces work and function together, but you need to be able to put the pieces together in the right way to get you to the right solution. Okay. So it's really proof that you are able to kind of approach a problem with minimal resources and come out with a success.
Okay. Now, from the standpoint of techs like me, who, for some reason, I think a lot of us get the term cybersecurity a little bad name, I guess, because for the most part, most techs are like, oh, well, we'll just throw AV on a system, we'll throw web protection on it, we'll put it behind a good firewall, and we're good. So having to go through all of that to get your certification, obviously, it's a lot more than that, right?
Right. No, there's actually very few technical questions on the CISSP exam. It's very much about interpreting what risk exists within an organization and what efforts can be made to mitigate or accept those risks. And in some cases, now that we're in the 21st century, transfer that risk to an insurance company, basically. So the actual engineering aspect of it is really just one small slice of those domains that ISC Squared expects you to know as a CISSP.
Okay.
So I kind of define cybersecurity as more of a culture of awareness within an organization, one that you have to understand the risks that exist for the line of business that you're in, and then apply the right protections to those risks. So it goes way above and beyond a lot of the technical aspects of cybersecurity. And, when you go through a lot of organizations, you do learn over time that it's not a technical problem. A lot of the time, it's a cultural one. The greatest existential risk to any company is going to be its employees.
So that kind of falls in line with what we've had to do to change our thinking when ransomware became rampant, where, a lot of times it wasn't just what can we do technically to stop it. It was training users to be able to identify the bad emails that they shouldn't click on. Exactly. Does that sound about
and
right?
And finding new and inventive ways to change the culture too.
Okay. So in terms of, I guess, the culture, so most of the time people think of cybersecurity in one of two ways. It's either, you know, ethical hacking or real hacking, mm-hmm. and the lines are getting blurred. And I know that Andrew, I don't know if it's Andrew. This was a question I was going to ask him, but he's not here. So I know that the University of Miami, where he teaches, has basically a two-tier course where they've got ethical hacking is one of their paths. So, you know, the first question, I guess, is there really such thing as ethical hacking?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there is a certification that goes into that. That's the CEH, the Certified Ethical Hacker, which is also a very real certification that is difficult to achieve, but it is definitely more technically focused.
Okay.
The ethical hackers are people who really are looking for the holes with the intent to plug them up. So it's not something where you are trying to exploit and gain advantage so much as you're trying to figure out the same puzzle with a different mentality around it, one of improving an organization rather than bringing it to its knees.
Okay. So there's now this specific certification to help us do that.
Yes, exactly. The CEH.
Yeah. Okay. CEH. So I'll put a link to that in the show note. And now it seems as though this is a mix of, because now I deal with HIPAA a lot of times and the compliance mm-hmm. factor. And even though we look at HIPAA as, you know, this overlying element of compliance for the healthcare industry, a lot of that is based from, you know, from what we have to do as techs on the security aspect. And people just look at it as a checklist. But how much of cybersecurity is based on those compliance programs that we always hear about, you know, like HIPAA, FINRA, and some of the others?
That's actually a complicated question. We have an interesting situation in the United States of America. We aren't really regulated on exactly what to do, like some other countries do define within their laws. We just kind of code it as do something. Understand what risks exist and do something that's in line with those risks. So we've had to come up with sets of guidelines, and there's a handful out there. There's going to be the ISO 27001, 27002. Those are the really old popular ones that are used internationally. It's a set of international standards of data governance and security. And if you want to really be HIPAA compliant or FINRA compliant, you're not going to be looking at the law so much as you're going to be looking at these guidelines and then tying in what little regulation exists within those laws to those guidelines and how you are applying those guidelines to your organization. And within the United States, we actually were very lucky in the last few years. Back in 2013, President Obama directed NIST to come up with new standards that are our own American standards of the ISO 27 guidelines. And those became the National Institute of Standards and Technology 800. And those are our version of the ISO 27 guidelines. And basically, these are available for free online. If you go look on the NIST website, you can actually get these spreadsheets that have been prepared by our own cybersecurity experts in the government. And you can go through line by line of these spreadsheets, and it's pretty easy to interpret what they're trying to say. They give you lots of helpful information in these spreadsheets. You can just click through the links, and it explains in basic plain English what these regulations and guidelines are supposed to do. And then all you do is you just type in what I've done to meet that guideline. It could be compliant software. It could be antivirus software. It could be a firewall rule, or it could even just be simple as corporate policy, which kind of goes back to that culture of changing the culture in a business to kind of understand cybersecurity as an organization rather than making it a technical problem. So these guidelines are really a mix of technical and non-technical benchmarks that we really have to meet to say that, hey, we are HIPAA compliant. We're really saying we're ISO 27 compliant, or we're NIST 800 compliant at the end of the day.
Okay. So I've seen a few of the NIST documents because I've come across them, and I know that I've seen the 800 series. I've also seen, 7621, where it's called the Small Business Information Security Fundamentals. You familiar with that one?
Not off the top of my head, actually.
Right.
That's the NIST IR, right?
Yes. Yep, that's it, NIST IR.
Yeah. So I unfortunately don't have the greatest exposure to this specific one because I've been using the NIST guidelines themselves. But yeah, this is exactly one of those things that you can look into for more information on what to do with an organization. Okay.
Yeah, I've pulled, it's funny because some of the 800s, I know that there's, you know, there's 800-111, 800-88, you know, for media sanitation and stuff like that. So I don't think I've ever seen the entire 800 document. I may have, I just don't remember. So, but that's there. Those are
available on the website, and I actually think I can get you a link on where to grab this from. It's a very, very, very long and very detailed document.
Oh yeah.
I'm looking at the NIST 7621 right now, and it actually is almost similar in a way. This is a little bit easier to interpret, I think, than some of the real heavy hitting guidelines out there.
Well, it's funny because the sanitation guideline itself is 64 pages. So,
I actually keep a copy of the NIST guidelines on my desktop here. I can pull it up.
Yeah. That's
I have 462 pages of guidelines and regulations.
So that's the entire NIST 800.
And that's in .10 font.
Yeah. That's a weekend read, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
All right. So I know that one of the things that you had talked to me pre-show was that your company, so the Design Studios, not only helps companies directly with their cybersecurity, but you're also now helping other tech companies with cybersecurity.
Yeah.
So let's start with what you do for other companies, because that seemed a little interesting for me. So one of the things you talked about was being able to take a company from the quote unquote mom and pop, you know, box store type security and bringing them into the real world enterprise type security. So that's something that I see a lot. And let's start with just tell me what made you guys focus on that and what do you see going on right now?
Circumstance. Is the one word answer to that one.
Yeah.
It's becoming a problem, really. The laws are getting better. A lot of states are starting to do mandates on what cybersecurity and data regulation is supposed to look like.
Okay.
So this used to be something that really only enterprise companies used to worry about. But now we're finding that even small business companies really, really need to worry about this because they're becoming the softest targets with the most sensitive data.
Okay.
So they are becoming targets as we start to automate a lot of what hackers used to have to do by hand. You know, ransomware is a great example of something that is automated now, but didn't actually used to be. It used to be a targeted attack. So we're seeing just this greater frequency of small businesses having issues and needing to worry about this. So we need to come up with solutions together on how can we start to protect our residents and our neighbors. This isn't something that we have to worry about at the corporate level. We have to worry about this at the community level. And this kind of goes back to that whole, we need a cultural shift and we need to define cybersecurity as a culture. And so that's kind of how I've approached this problem, where I'm looking at these smaller managed service providers, not as competitors and people who are taking business away from me, so much as people that I can provide my services to help enhance their business and also help them leverage their clients into additional growth. One of the things that I try to really take away from what good security looks like is that good security is marketable. It's something that actually sells. And as we're trying to explain to small business why this is a worthy investment, that's really what comes up. What do I gain from this? Because good security is invisible. It's not something you really feel that you're getting any benefit from when it works. So it's something that you really need to learn how to leverage into opportunities. And that's kind of where we're seeing these written information security plans coming into play. These are state regulated documents that you need to have. But companies can use them to help increase their marketing. So they're approaching their clients and their business saying, hey, we really care about you and we want to take care of your personal information. So this is what we're doing to protect the credit card numbers and the bank account numbers that we may have. This is especially important with CPAs and the small doctor's offices that they really need to have these, even though they might not have more than 8 to 10 employees. But it's a way for them to increase business just by showing off that they are doing their due diligence with their client's data. And when a client has a choice between the guy who talked to them about how their security is going to affect them versus the company that didn't bring it up at all, the client's going to always go with the company that talked about what they're doing to protect their client.
Okay. So let me go back and just ask a quick question about when you're talking about companies making the jump from, you know, the small, you know, basic business security to a real enterprise type security. Are we talking about a big jump, first of all?
It doesn't have to be. This is something that even small businesses can worry about. And this is why we are starting to partner up with these really small MSPs and those smart hand technicians who are just doing basic tech support for an office. They can come to us and we can say, okay, for basically what amounts to a nominal fee, you can have a security operations center as part of your portfolio as a tech support guy. And so we can provide these sort of medium and up solutions to the very small business crowd. So they're getting the benefit of a security operations center for, you know, comparable pricing to an antivirus solution. And then they're still dealing with their favorite tech support guy for all of those daily threats and printer problems that they're dealing with. So it's a real boon to small businesses to have access to this because, like I said, they're the softest targets with the most sensitive data.
Right.
Because they may not be doing enough. The other kind of flip side where maybe you're not looking at the local tech support guy is that big problem that a lot of companies face when they're going from, you know, the 10 to 15 employees to the 20 and up. So that typically translates to about $2, $5, $10 million in revenue. Or $50 million in assets and up. And a lot of companies run into problems at this point because they're trying to twist around the system that worked for them. You know, they might be on that Google suite with the 8 to 10 employees for years and years. They've built their workflow around it and it's an effective solution for them. But then they reach the 15 to 20 employees and they lose the ability to do the micromanaging that was probably part of their culture and workflow as a small business. So that's really what happens to the small business as they start to grow into the medium business is the owners and the managers begin to erode that ability to micromanage and answer minute-to-minute questions from their employees. So you have to worry about what solutions exist to prevent A, data leaks, which is a problem, in my opinion, with Google Suite, that employees can share links to data outside of the organization. And by default, out of the box, that might actually work. And then that link can make it out onto the internet where just about anyone can view it. And you have to kind of move them over to a solution that worries a little bit more about data loss protection,
right?
Which is part of the Office 365 suite for kind of the comparable solution to G Suite. But these solutions are there. And that's what a lot of small businesses have to worry about as they grow is they have to do away with the small business solutions they were using, which again goes back to the cultural shift. They're going to be changing their workflow. They're going to be changing their policy and their approach to data governance at a fundamental level. And that really is difficult for a lot of the upper management and owners to accept is that the fundamental foundation that they built their business out of from a technological perspective must change. And it changes at step one with policy and culture.
Right. But aren't we dealing with a backlash where, you know, owners now are being told, you know, you don't really need an IT department. You don't need an IT guy to help you. Just, you know, use these tools. And we're dealing with I don't want to say it's a generational shift, but it might be because I'm an older guy. But I mean, people want to do their own tech. They don't want to rely on somebody else. So isn't that something that we're fighting against in the midst of all of this?
Absolutely. And this is kind of a two-edged sword to me because I look at automation as generally a good thing. But it results in these sort of depersonalization where you might be doing away with the IT guys as you're trying to grow, because you might need to shift your resources away from that $145 an hour guy over to a subscription service that you absolutely must have under your data governance policy. So a lot of small business owners are looking at this like a choice between A and B.
Right.
And we have to look at it as, again, a cultural problem of what do we do as the technicians as we're being outgrown in some cases to finding the right automation. There has to be a middle ground, basically. And so it always comes back to finding what's the balance between the two, because it's always a bad idea to give up your tech support guy.
It is for us.
Not maintaining those relationships means that your SLAs are just not going to be there. So when that printer stops working and you got to get that $10,000 invoice out the door to close the sale, that's a pretty significant loss compared to maintaining your tech support guy's monthly fee to stay on board.
Okay.
So businesses have to look at it as what's at risk versus the cost of the tech, and what's at risk versus the cost of some of this compliance software. And that's my role as a CISSP, is to figure out what is that happy medium between the two solutions that's going to get the business the greatest leverage to grow and reduce risk in the most cost-effective way. And that's part of what we're doing with these technicians, trying to offset the SOC to them, because we can manage these systems at a cost that's really, again, like I said, not too much different from what they might be paying for their antivirus subscriptions. So the technicians are able to keep their clients by shifting some of the risk over to us to tackle.
So here's a question then. Is it easier to talk to an end user or a business owner about cybersecurity, or is it harder to talk to a technician about cybersecurity?
Those are two very different things, actually.
Okay.
And I kind of define a CISSP as the certification that says you speak both languages. That's really what a lot of the test focuses on when you go and sit in the testing center, is trying to figure out how to explain this technical problem to a CEO in a way that they're maybe 8 years old mentally.
Right.
So you're trying to distill all of these problems that are really difficult to explain in a fundamental grade school level. So it really comes down to good communication to both parties. You have to be able to speak both of those languages to kind of communicate between the two of them. And that's also part of the small business to medium business challenge, is the language changes. So the simple technical problems become complicated technical problems. And the CEO still needs to understand why what cost $1,000 2 years ago is now going to cost them $6,000 today.
Right.
Again, for what looks like little benefit to them.
Okay.
So it is a necessary component of their data governance.
Absolutely. Yeah. The company that used to spend money on tech support just when they needed it now has to spend it every single month. And that's a big shift. Exactly. For them.
It's a big shift. It's a really big shift. And, you know, and for the technicians out there, there's a sales pitch that I love to come back to over and over and over again, because it's one that I found to be extremely successful with the business owners. And it's a allegory, basically. So you basically ask, how much did you spend on your car, right? So if they drive a new car, they might say something like, oh, $35,000. And then you ask them, well, how much do you spend every month to insure that investment? And then they would say something like, oh, maybe $100 to $150. So you're like, okay, good. So we can put a ratio on what value exists within your car asset to what you're willing to pay to protect it. Now, how much is your business worth to you? Right. And is that business based on the amount of sales that it generates? No, that's not really how we evaluate the value of business. It's based on what the data is within the corporation. So for financial firms, that number is often equated to, well, how much money is in the bank accounts that exist? If I could log into their systems and pull the bank accounts out, that company is really worth the value of the assets it manages. And so if you pull that number out, a lot of the time for small to medium businesses, it might be $50 million. It's like, well, how much are you willing to spend to insure that $50 million asset? And that becomes the basic number that we use for a cybersecurity governance program. And that really puts it in perspective to them to understand, like, oh, wow, this is a worthy investment at this point, because we're trying to protect something that is worth far more than I actually thought it was to begin with.
So I have used a similar allegory to that, and I don't remember exactly what it was I used because I stopped using it. But the argument that I, at the time, didn't have an answer for, but is, you know, I spend insurance on my car because it's mandated. It's the law, just like homeowners insurance and stuff like that. So from a business perspective, it's not really, you know, they're not really mandated to spend that money to insure it. So do you ever come across that argument from people?
I haven't, but, you know, I feel like there's a good rebuttal to this one regardless. So this line hasn't been used on me, but what I would say to that is, well, what are you willing to lose then? You know, accidents happen. If you were in an accident, what would you do?
All right. That's the, right. That is, so the, that
you
is
might
the better
not
question.
Be mandated to have it, but what would you do in that worst case scenario if it did happen? Yeah. Where would that put you in your life?
That is a very good question. I've used something close to that. So it's basically, yeah, you know, how much downtime are you willing to put up with? You know, how, you know, if you lost all of this stuff today, what would that do to you? So they usually, you know, start to respond when the question of loss comes up.
How many days can you operate before you're insolvent? It's a good one.
Right. Okay. So with all of these things, so now you mentioned providing this Security Operations Center, or the SOC. So yeah, if you were presenting this, well, you have, and for my listeners, what types of things can they get in a Security Operations Center that they're not able to get currently through their, you know, RMM platform or their managed services that they're doing, stuff like that? Mm-hmm. What types of things come with the SOC?
So I'm going to throw a new acronym out there that our listeners might not know too well. There's the MSP. Everyone knows the Managed Services Provider.
Yeah.
We now have an extra letter in that. It's the MSSP, the Managed Security Services Provider.
Right.
What you're going to find is the biggest difference between the two is the level of human interaction that really goes into enforcing that compliance. You're using tools that are a little bit more robust. So you might pull antivirus out of the box, you install it, and then you might not even ever touch it again. You just kind of expect it to automatically update.
Right.
You kind of expect it to flag things and maybe even operate silently in the background. The biggest difference between an MSP and the MSSP is that there's going to be a human element to interpreting the log files that are coming out of these antivirus solutions. So you have a little bit more of a robust antivirus package in general, all purely because there's extra compliance tick boxes that you're going to check off as you're setting it up.
Right.
Not that the software itself might be appreciably different, but then there's that additional human element where remediation is enforced. So every time that there's a problem with the system, it doesn't get ignored. It's addressed. Even if it's as simple as just looking at it and saying, oh yeah, that's fine. Okay. But we're still doing the due diligence of examining every single flag that comes out of the machine to make sure that it's meeting the requirements of the organization's compliance.
All right. So basically, from a small MSP perspective, that's kind of like been our missing component, is we normally don't have time to go through each and every check every single day and make sure that the remediation is being done. So the security operations system is going to make sure that that happens.
Exactly. Yes, they follow up and they make sure that they're going through everything. And one of the big changes that you might see with a SOC versus or the MSSP and versus the MSP is we'll shut a machine off and put that employee out for the day if it really comes down to it. Because the data security is such an important component when you try to worry about this stuff. We don't want machines to be operating just, you know, sending out that hourly notification of I have a problem. It makes a lot more sense a lot of the time to just turn it off until we can get the time to look at it.
So if there is a infection or threat that is not able to be immediately addressed, literally system shuts down and they can't operate?
Basically, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, oh. What type of backlash have you had for that?
Minimal, okay. Really. So when you kind of go in with this sort of transformative procedures, you really want to also provide backup plans. Any good cybersecurity and data governance plan is going to have a way to get around a problem. You don't want to just say, okay, this employee can't work. We're shutting them down. They're done. You really want to be shutting that machine down and then handing them a loaner machine that the office maintains. So they just get one extra workstation out of those 10 that they're buying every year.
Right.
And it just sits on the shelf as a hot spare. So that's one of the really cheap ways. And the cost of that is easily justified if your employees are generating the cost of that machine on a daily basis. It makes a lot of sense to just keep a hot spare on the shelf in that case.
So
then again, it goes back to the cultural shift. You kind of have to buy a little bit more upfront than you might otherwise have in the past, but you're preserving that revenue stream over time, and it will pay for itself and return that investment.
Right. Which is easy for my law firm clients, where everything to them is based on either a billable hour or in a sense of they're working on, you know, a $10 million judgment or something like that. So a machine going down really, you know, hurts them in that sense. And they understand that. Most other customers may not have that sense of, you know, what does it cost me per hour to be down? So having that extra machine for $500 to $1,000 makes a whole lot of sense if you have an employee that can't work for a day and maybe it's 3 days and they're losing, you know, $2,000 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, that all comes back to what SLA clients really need to have. And understanding what that number should be is a big part of what the corporate owners need to be worrying about. Again, going back to cybersecurity cultural shifts, the business owners themselves need to understand all of the numbers that goes into the communication flow within their organization. They should understand how much revenue each role makes within a company. They should understand what level of tolerance there can be to downtime and then scale their operations accordingly. And a lot of the time, these folks are more than happy to understand what these numbers are because they see them every day. They're looking at their books and they understand how much money Karen makes for the corporation on a daily basis, especially if they're still the small business. They know exactly how much money these people are making. And it just kind of becomes a question that you ask them. It's like, hey, if Karen's not working, what's that going to do for you guys? Should we worry about that before there's a problem? And you kind of just have to work it that way. It's like, hey, should we worry about something that isn't a problem yet? Does that really make sense? You know, what's it going to cost you?
So here's a question that is kind of off topic a little bit, but for, say, a technician that, you know, is starting out or is a small MSP, and, you know, you're going in to talk to the business owner and you're trying mm-hmm. to get them to, you know, a lot of times we are afraid to ask about money. You know, it's one thing to try to present them, well, here's what it's going to cost to use our services or my services. Now turn that around and try to ask them, so, you know, how much, you know, value is your business over such and such? So it sounds like there is a mind shift that has to be done on the technician side to be able to have those conversations with business owners or key players within a business to talk about risk in terms of dollars. So that sounds to me like that's not something that you go through the certification training. So how do you kind of learn that as you go?
Again, this is kind of the experience component of CISSP. You're right. I didn't study to know what those numbers are. But I definitely knew what they were going into the test based on my previous experiences. I had a solution for this even before I was certified. Basically what I do is I went through and I did what any quality assurance individual or auditor will do, which is put together a business impact analysis, the BIA, which is used across so many different industries. We still use it in the IT world and the cybersecurity world, but the BIA really speaks to upper management. So it's not something that you necessarily need to do with them. You just kind of give them a worksheet with the questions on it. And this is what I did. I went through a BIA for multiple different organizations that I managed. So I went through a BIA for a financial firm, a healthcare firm, lawyer's office, and just kind of tried to wrap my head around all of the different acronyms like the ARO and all those fun things, the annual rate of occurrence, by the way. So after that, I just kind of combined all of these BIAs into one document. And I said, hey, I will be happy to sit down with you and try to answer these questions with you. But as the business owner, I think you should worry about this as your cybersecurity professional. I think that you should take this worksheet, sit down and really think about it. And then why don't we have a conversation about the risk that exists within your organization after you figure out how to put a number on it? And after I did this, I actually started to see my sales creep up. My actual closed sales from that, I was able to speak more to these written plans and coming up with these more cybersecurity plans, because the CEOs really, they took them seriously. You know, we're one of the few employees of their organization that are not privy to the day-to-day interactions with these employees. We might have friendships and bonds with those employees, but we're not exposed to the general gossip of an office, and we're not in there every day. We're kind of these third-party observers that become trusted third-party observers. So a lot of the time, the CEOs will trust us a lot more than we might think, just based on these ongoing relationships. So you can give them these BIA worksheets that you put together, just be like, hey, I've seen this at a couple of organizations. I think you guys might benefit from this. Why don't you take a look and you can do it or not? But here it is regardless. And that thought alone is often enough for them to actually at least think about it, read it and think about it rather than sitting down and doing it. And then they'll come back and be like, you know what? I think that we should think about this a little bit more. And I think that this gave me, you know, A, B, C ideas. What do you think?
Okay. So let me ask a follow-up question to that, because most of the time, we never really call them business impact analysis. We always talk, you know, and most techs are going to understand it as recovery time. You know, it's always based on, you know, the business backup and recovery plan. How long can you stay out of business? But from a security standpoint, there's so much more, it sounds like, that goes into this. So you're talking about...
Yeah, no, cybersecurity is definitely more than just disaster recovery and backup alone.
Right.
So it's not even just downtime that can kind of impact an organization. You know, ransomware might have a downtime component to it. It might have an insolvency component to it. If you don't have backups and disaster recovery, SOL on that one.
Right. It's always tough. I know it's always tough when you talk about that type of stuff, because that's, as techs, that's all we're taught to think about is, you know, hey, how, you know, you just got to keep me up and running, and I don't want any downtime. And I don't want to lose my data, but it's...
Right. You know, so here's an example of something that's not disaster recovery related, but does impact a business. What if Karen was phished that one day, right? And it wasn't ransomware that was in that email attachment. She clicked what she thought was an Office 365 reset password screen, typed in her password, and that sent an email off to a far-flung hacker in a foreign nation. Who then just logs into the organization and just snoops through and steals all of the PII. And then you hear, you know, a couple months later from one of your clients, my identity was stolen. And we're trying to figure out how and why. And I know that you guys have my personal information. Can we look into it? So suddenly you're being subpoenaed by the Attorney General's office because there's a suspected data breach for fraud. There's no downtime component to this at all. Just were operating under normal pretenses. Karen totally forgot that she clicked through and gave a foreign actor her password. And then a company is facing an investigation from the Attorney General's office, which has a huge, huge cost component to it. Even if you did no wrong and you can prove it in the end, there's still going to be an associated cost to that investigation that's going to be, you know, kicking your door in. So we have to worry more about just disaster. We have to worry about day-to-day operations even, and trying to protect the organization from theft and fraud.
So in that type of scenario, and where I talk to, you know, my HIPAA clients is, you know, we're not talking about just protection. We're not talking about time. Like you said, you now talking about where somebody comes to you months later and you now have to present logs and or evidence as to whether you protected them or not, or to find out if there was a hack or a fish. So I know that most of us don't have access to the products that will keep those logs for very long. Most firewall logs are gone in a few hours. Most server logs are gone in a few days. In terms of your security operations center, I'm assuming that all of these components will retain logs for, you know, a indefinite amount of time so that that type of stuff can be done, correct?
Yes and no. You're indeed correct that certain audit trails need to be preserved. That's very true under HIPAA. We worry about that all the time. But organizations also need to understand risk acceptance as well. So you're right. Those solutions to kind of manage the continual flow and creep of these audit logs can be intense. We can meet the letter of HIPAA to kind of audit the logs periodically, know who's logging in and logging out. And we, as a SOC, we can kind of filter out what we think is suspicious and retain that versus everything gets logged. But at the end of the day, you know, if you don't have the resources to kind of maintain these continual audit trails, you need to think about other solutions that reduce the risk so that that becomes an acceptable risk. So in the instance of this, there's some really cheap services out there. One would be teach Karen what phishing looks like by actually sending her phishing emails. A lot of services are out there today that are extremely affordable that lets them test their employees on a monthly, you know, 6 week or 6 month basis so that they can actually be exposed to what these risks look like. That's one method of risk reduction. So you're lowering your employees' likelihood to click through by giving them that basic training, which is extremely affordable even for the smallest of businesses. You can also encrypt these machines so that laptops that are stolen, you just kind of shrug your shoulders and buy a new one. Unencrypted laptops might turn into a report to the Attorney General. And that's another thing that can be turned on in 10 minutes. You know, a TPM for a laptop is pretty standard at this point. And if it's not, it's a $50 add-on.
Right.
And then it's 10 minutes of tech time to deploy BitLocker to that machine. Every company should be doing this at this point, encrypting their machines. It should just be a default.
Right.
That's one way to reduce risk so that physical theft is not a problem anymore. Then you can also have firewalls that are a little bit more intuitive. So you're not using the SOHO because you know that you're dealing with sensitive data. You're not dealing with just emails, addresses, and names. You have either healthcare, social security numbers, over a certain number of them anyway, credit card numbers, and bank statements, and that like. You shouldn't be using the small home office firewall anymore. You should be using something that actually has the ability to passively sniff all of those packets that are coming in the front door so that Karen never gets that phishing email to begin with. Your firewall has already blocked it from coming into the organization. That's one more way to reduce risk in a very cost-effective way. So the difference between a SOHO and the next tier up is usually a few hundred bucks with an additional few hundred bucks on a yearly basis for the subscription.
Right.
But that additional, you know, $800 versus the risk of your company goes out of business because you're facing a $50 million lawsuit, it's pretty substantial. You know, it's a no-brainer, really, even for the small businesses. If my risk from this BIA is millions and millions of dollars and jail time, well, I'm going to spend $1,000.
That's right.
To get the right tool. You know, so you end up reducing risk with many different solutions, then it becomes an acceptable risk because you've invested in other ways and you meet the very bare minimum of the regulation so that you are legal, but then you're still also compliant and everything is safe. And then you just kind of, you know, again, you shrug your shoulders and hope that Karen never clicks through because she's been trained and the tools are in place.
Right. All right. So definitely having an advanced UTM, which is something that I've pretty much required of all my customers, especially when it comes to HIPAA, because now that the focus has shifted to where anybody that is a business associate now has responsibility in any type of breach.
Yeah.
So you know, look, if there's a risk of me, you know, being targeted by, you know, OSHA or whoever's, you know, the HIPAA police are, I'm going to protect myself along with your company. So that sounds like something we all should be doing. So,
and you know, it's worth saying too that we expose ourselves as the professionals. We do expose ourselves to a certain level of risk as well. If we are the third party service provider for these organizations, we will be involved in any regulatory compliance investigations that are coming from the state. So we should worry about them as the service providers as well, and strongly urge clients who are non-compliant to move towards that. And then not shy away from firing them because they present too much risk to myself. And I don't want to accept their negligence and within my portfolio.
I was going to ask that if you guys had actually either turned away and or fired customers because they were unwilling to either make themselves accept the risk or reduce the risk and let you do your job to protect them.
I have done that not just with design studios, but many different MSPs that I've served with over the last 15 years.
Okay. Hmm. All right. I'm sorry. I was making notes earlier that there's all of these phrases that you were using for risk awareness, risk acceptance, risk reduction. There's another couple in there and I'm thinking, do you have a spreadsheet of all the risk adjective words in there?
That's going to be domain one of the CISSP handbook from ISC.
Really, it is?
Yes, that's domain one. Yep. Oh. Yeah. There is a spreadsheet, in fact, and I can get that over to you. But this whole idea of understanding the risk of an organization is 1/8 of the CISSP certification.
Oh, my. I thought I was just being funny here because it sounded pretty cool to have all these risk words. Tied to it, but
yeah, part of the CISSP lingo.
All right, beautiful. So CISSP Certified Information System Security Professional. Whew.
That's mouthful.
So
AKA the CISP.
That's worse than your last name of Milicheski.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, Kyle. Well, we're coming up on an hour here. I want to thank you for your time today. And please let Andrew know that I'm kind of bummed that he wasn't able to be here. I will get him on the show on a later date. And I know that probably something will come up from my listeners is knowing that you and your company will actually help smaller techs with this security component of cybersecurity. If they reach out to me or if you want them to reach out to you, is there contact information that you'd be willing to let me put into the show note for them to contact you guys?
Absolutely. We would be happy to talk with them. You guys are not our competitors. You're definitely our friends and we want to help you grow your business.
Okay. All right. So Kyle Milicheski with Design Studios LLC, obviously a cybersecurity specialist, professional, whatever you want to call it, guru, definitely somebody that you want to talk to folks if you need help with cybersecurity. Kyle, any last words you want to throw out there before we end off the show?
Yeah, actually, we spoke briefly before this, interview of one thing I wanted to touch on. So I went to the Secure World Conference last week, and one of the things that they talk about, this is part of the CISSP continuing education, it's going to these conferences. And one of the biggest threats that kind of took me back by surprise is that a high school student can now purchase denial of service attacks with their mom's credit card for $25. So these aren't hacktivist groups out there that can launch, you know, cybersecurity attacks against your business. It's your nephew and your disgruntled son or daughter that can go in and purchase these attacks. And it's surprising how enabled the average person is at this point to become a significant cybersecurity threat for a small organization.
Okay, let me first get this through my head. $25 to do a...
Yeah.
Now, is this a simple DOS attack or is this pretty sophisticated?
I would not say it's simple. No, this is a 10 gigabit and 3 second attack. So it's more than capable of bringing down your website on AWS. And if you're doing business there, then the duration of that downtime now just became your cost.
Wow. Now, is this something that they have to go to the dark web to find, or is this something that's pretty easily accessible?
It's not dark web. That would be deep web. They just got to know where to look. They don't need any special tools to go get it. Just a credit card and a basic knowledge of Bitcoin.
Okay. So this is deep web. And I did a show a while back.
Googleable, let's put it that way.
Googleable, okay. That's what I knew.
This might not be something that you find on the first page, but when you get to the eighth page in a specific forum, the link will be there.
Okay. We're not going to say that here. Oh, my. All right. So the Secure World Conference. So that sounds like a pretty big deal.
It's a fun conference that is put together by actually a conglomeration of organizations. I was invited by the ISSA, which is kind of the the IEEEs of the security world.
Okay. I was looking at the page. There is a thing called Debunking the Myth of the Firewall.
Yeah.
So were you at the one in Boston?
In Boston, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Debunking the myths around the human firewall. That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah. I unfortunately didn't see that keynote, but I did get to see Bruce Schneier, who recently wrote a really great book called Click Here to Kill Everybody, which was very fun to see him rant on stage for an hour and a half. It was highly entertaining, and I hope that they put that up on YouTube at some point.
Wow. So that's the title of this book, Click Here to Kill Everybody.
Yes, that's the title.
Oh, my. That sounds interesting. And I guess if you can buy a DOS attack for $25, there probably shouldn't be too many more clicks to to do much more damage.
Mm. No, and that's kind of my takeaway. It's like, there's a lot of wow factor. That it's so enabled, but this is not just a one-off thing. This is a trend. It's getting easier and easier for the average person to become a cybersecurity threat. Our threat landscape isn't limited to professionals and people who understand cybersecurity. It's becoming an issue for everybody at all levels. And automation is only going to make it easier over time, especially as we kind of dive down this rabbit hole of cryptocurrency and how easy it is to get into that. You know, we have non-technical people who are mining Bitcoin at this point. So
right. Yep.
These things are becoming easier and more prevalent in our society. And as this trend continues, it's only going to become easier. And I hope that we don't wind up in a threat landscape that is completely deregulated over the next 5 to 10 years, because we didn't worry about this continuing trend of cybersecurity automation.
So,
on both sides, defense and offense.
Right. So I know we were about ready to end off here, but now I'm sitting here thinking we had so much more we could have talked about. Now, is there a real, true fear that, we hear about, the Russians, and their spy stuff, and we hear about, China embedding stuff in our electronics and things like that. I mean, how close or how far away do you think we are to something really happening like that?
It already is.
Okay.
Without question. Yeah.
All right. Then,
there are now tools online where you can see the amount of traffic moving through the undersea cables and the major backbones. And I invite all of the listeners to go look at that, because they can kind of see the actions of these state actors as they're going, and you can actually see all of this data move from point A to point B and then targeting specific geographic locations. It's fascinating to watch. And if you kind of get engrossed in it over months, you'll see changes that might actually match the headlines you're seeing in the news.
Interesting. We may have to do a whole show based on that. That sounds intense.
Yeah, it's the internet map, it's called.
Internet map, okay. All right, I'm sure that'll be... That up, we'll definitely get a link in there. Actually, one of my listeners will probably send it to me, because I'm sure they go on that stuff. because I don't have the time.
There's actually quite a few out there, okay. But it's worth looking into for sure.
All right. Well, we will end on that note and look forward to future shows on that. So, Kyle, thank you again very much for coming on. We'll be looking forward to talking to you again. I'm sure I will see you at some point down here. You're, you know, less than 35 minutes from me. So we'll run into each other soon. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we just finished talking with Kyle Malicheski from Design Studios. He is a true CISSP, and you've just heard the introductory course on cybersecurity. Kyle, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on today.
All right. So, folks, those of you that are still here, be sure to support the show. If you do have questions, tips, show suggestions, send them to me at marvin@podnuts.com. Follow us on Twitter. We have the acronym @PodNutsPro. We always announce when the show's coming on, throw some other stuff in there in between. If you would like to support the show, if you go to the show note, there is a Amazon link. It is basically a link to a little store that I set up. But if you use that link and go get anything that you normally get on Amazon, your price is the same. But when you check out, a little commission comes back to PodNuts Pro to help us do some great things with the show. And of course, go back and pay attention to our sponsor, Calyptid Security. Go to the GoFundMe page for Eric Ardini and head over to TechConUnplugged.com and get your ticket for the conference this September in Michigan. And that is going to do it for our show tonight. I thank you all for listening and downloading. Tell all your friends about us, and we'll talk to you again soon. And until next time, holla. Hello, everyone, and thank you for staying tuned after the podcast for this special message. And basically, folks, what I wanted to do is let everybody know that this episode was actually recorded before Friday, April 5th, when Eric Ardini lost his battle with cancer. And I debated on whether or not to toss the show, edit the show, or do something different, but I decided to go ahead and keep the show intact and to just simply add this message afterwards. And I wanted to do so just to reiterate the help that I think is still going to be needed, even though the battle is over. And one of the things that I have come to realize in life is that I'm at an age now where I am starting to lose people for various reasons. And I have had a few people already battle cancer. The latest before Eric was a friend that was lost 2 years ago, who was lucky enough to have survived 3 years when they didn't think that she would have 6 months. And one of the things that I just want to reiterate to people after the fact is that just because the battle is over, the medical bills are still there. The need for assistance is still there. We already know, well, I don't know if you know, but you know, 1 in 3 cancer patients have to turn to family or friends, not only to pay for care, but a lot of them still end up filing for bankruptcy, losing their house. And those are just things that we should not have to be dealing with in this day and age. And so when Tara set up the GoFundMe page and everybody here in the PodNuts community decided to link to it and to help, there's a very good reason for that. One, Eric was a friend of ours, and two, the help, the need is real. So just because Eric has lost his battle and we now have to look forward, the medical bills, I'm sure, are still there for the family. The normal day-to-day expenses, you know, just, you know, cost of living, groceries, gas. We still need to contribute to help Eric's family. So his wife, Kathy, and his two children are somebody that we need to continue to support. I am going to keep the link in the show note for this show as long as that GoFundMe page is there and active. And I am going to encourage everybody, if you have already gone and contributed and contribute more, please do so. If you have not gone and contributed, please do so. If you can share the link with somebody, please do that. So Eric has been a part of the Podnuts community for quite some time. He actually started hosting in 2011. As many of you know, I've said earlier that the reason I am here doing this show now is because of people like Eric that came before me and contributed being a podcaster on some of these shows. Eric not only was an avid podcaster, he was a huge community person. And I'm sure by now you have heard all of the things that Eric has done, you know, being very heavily involved in his community. I mean, serving for many, many years while running his computer repair shop. He's one of us, folks. He was a tech. And then he also contributed to his community. He served. I mean, he was alderman. He was the police and fire commissioner. City clerk was his last job. And he still had time for all of his other stuff. He had his business up until 2013. He had his family. He had all those things. So as a community, we can continue to contribute to Eric's memory by continuing to contribute to the GoFundMe page. Again, I'm going to keep the show link as part of the notes permanently until that page is down. And so I just want to encourage you to continue to do that. I know I rambled, and I'm sorry, but I thank you for staying tuned after the podcast and listening to this. And we will continue doing what we do. And Eric, we miss you. And until we see you again, holla.